Yemeni army once again threatens the UAE with further attacks, advising the country to leave the Saudi-led coalition's war on Yemen. In brazen support for Israel's crimes against Palestinians, the U.S. rejects the view that the regime's actions amount to apartheid. And at least a dozen historically black colleges and universities in the U.S. receive threats of bomb attacks and mass shootings as Black History Month begins. Hello everyone, and thank you for tuning in to World News. And Al Sana'a renews its warning to the United Arab Emirates to end its aggression against the Yemeni people. In a tweet, Army spokesperson Yahya Saris noted, "Safety of the expo being held in Dubai depends on the United Arab Emirates' conduct." Saris had earlier warned that the UAE will come under continued strikes as long as it targets the Yemeni people. On Monday, the Yemeni army launched a third operation against the UAE, hitting significant targets, including sensitive facilities in the capital, Abu Dhabi. UAE is part of the Saudi-led coalition that's been waging war on Yemen since March of 2015. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians, have been killed in the onslaught. The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement says U.S. and Israel are the real enemies of Muslims, exploiting divisions among the Muslim Ummah to achieve their goals. Abdul Malik al-Houthi said the policy of the UAE and Saudi Arabia on Yemen is in line with Israel's stance, as evidenced by a recent trip by Israel's president to the UAE. He noted that Saudi Arabia allowed a plane carrying the Israeli delegation to fly over the kingdom while it prevents Yemeni people from using their own airspace. He said Israel and its loyalists consider the Yemeni people as their common enemy. Houthi slammed the Saudi-led coalition's recent airstrikes on a prison in northern Yemen as a deliberate attempt to create a massacre. He said the coalition bombed the prison while the UN and other international bodies were well aware of the location of that facility. The U.S. has rejected the view that Israel's actions toward Palestinians constitutes apartheid. The U.S. spokesperson for the U.S. State Department says that they've never used such terminology. Ned Price referred to the Israeli regime as the world's only Jewish state, saying Jews must not be denied their right to self-determination. Remarks come after an international rights group accused Israel of apartheid for its treatment of Palestinians. Claim also prompted an angry response from Tel Aviv, which has denounced the report as anti-Semitic. Meanwhile, Iran has condemned Israel for following racist expansionist policies. Tehran says Israel remains as the only apartheid regime in the world, despite outstanding calls from the international community to stop its violations of Palestinians' rights. Political commentator Jim Cavanaugh says Israel is blatantly an apartheid regime, and while everybody has accepted this, the U.S. rejects it, with President Joe Biden calling himself a Zionist.
Israeli human rights group B'Tselem itself says that Israel is an apartheid regime from the river to the sea. Human Rights Watch says this is apartheid. This is the privileging of one religious ethnic group over another. To be specific, it's ethno-religious supremacism of a blatant kind. It's clear that the Jewish population is fully enfranchised in a way that the Palestinian Arabs never will be. Palestinian Arabs are worse than second-class citizens. They just don't count. You know, a Jewish person from anywhere in the world has the right to arrive in Israel and have fully enfranchised rights. Palestinians who live there for decades and centuries and generations are losing their homes and their land under the rubric of Jewish supremacy. That's what this is about. You know, it's a colonialist situation. Has been from the beginning. It was instituted at the end of World War II when colonialism was still kind of something you could think of as okay, and the Palestinian Arabs just were not as important as the European Jews who were coming from displaced persons camps. So, you know, everybody's accepted this. The United States, Joe Biden, called himself a Zionist.
At least a dozen historically black colleges and universities in the U.S. have received threats of mass shootings and bomb attacks. Threats in cities from Baltimore to New Orleans has forced authorities to enforce campus lockdowns, and this coincides with the first day of U.S. Black History Month. On Monday, a wave of similar threats forced the cancellation of classes at other schools. The White House says it takes these threats, quote, incredibly serious, but that they still don't know what has motivated the threats. Last year, U.S. intelligence services warned that racially motivated violent extremists such as white supremacists will seek to carry out mass casualty attacks in the country. And joining us now from Washington, D.C. is Dr. Colin Campbell for more on the story. Hello, Colin. Hope you're safe and doing well out there. What is this all about? Do we know where these threats came from, or do we think we know where these threats are coming from and why? And if you could briefly tell us what Black History Month is all about for our international viewers, Colin.
Threats that have happened at more than a dozen, almost two dozen black, historically black colleges and universities, otherwise known as HBCUs in our country. And Black History Month started out as Black History Week. Carter G. Woodson started this out as an homage to understanding the black experience in America, which is unique to any experience around the world, where enslaved Africans were brought here and a country was built upon the backs of those enslaved Africans to be a superpower, never giving the financial reparations to those enslaved Africans to which the country achieved greatness, quote-unquote greatness, from. Now we have Black History Month, where it's a time to look into the Black American experience, its history, and the contributions that Black Americans have made to the country, as well as looking forward what the future means for Black Americans here. At the same time, we're in a political climate where we've seen the increase of white hegemons that want to control the future of America and its separation of races, where there would be some of an apartheid dynamic and giving deference of one race over another. We're also seeing a divided political country as well. And so with the beginning of Black History Month, we saw a rise in the number of bomb threats across the Eastern Seaboard, which is where a lot of HBCUs are. At the university I teach at Howard University here in Washington, D.C., there was a temporary lockdown and the ability to hold classes was in question. And this is the second semester for the calendar year. Last semester, Howard University also received bomb threats, but also was a victim of a major cyber attack. And when I say major, it shut down and locked up a lot of computers for several days. There are scores of computers that can never be turned on, or at the very least, can never be reconnected to Howard's infrastructure for the fear that it could contaminate and spread a virus among the computers on campus. So I say all that to say that HBCUs, Howard University, of course, is constantly under attack from cyber bullies or security threats or those who just wish the worst for its black population or its black students and faculty here in the country.
And what's the pushback from calling it? People don't want people. Are there forces in America that do not want to see the black American gain their equality? What's this? What's the pushback from? What's the objective of this kind of pushback?
There could be myriad reasons. And of course, we've always studied the impact of whenever black Americans make strides in American culture, there's always been what is called a white lash or some type of retribution. And that retribution comes in various forms, whether it's statues that have been erected during the Civil Rights era or right after the Reconstruction era in the early 1900s, just after black Americans won their freedom or earned their freedom. We saw statues erected that paid homage or gave tribute to Confederate states. And these were the states that wanted to secede from the country in order to preserve slavery as an institution in those respective states. We have seen mobs and zoot suit riots and just riots in general, scores of people just bombing black businesses and black districts because they were thriving too much for their estimation. We've seen systemic discrimination from various businesses, from colleges and schools, and each generation, or every several years, there needs to be a major fight in order for black Americans to win equality and equity in the country. And now at a time when we're starting to see strides happening with more educated black Americans, black women are the most educated ethnic group in our country. When we're seeing these strides, we are also seeing a commensurate white lash that we have seen historically whenever black Americans increase their autonomy, increase their agency, and increase their socioeconomic mobility.
All right, Colin, stay safe out there, but thank you for that update. From Washington, D.C., Dr. Colin Campbell there joining us. Now, the Russian president has warned against U.S. attempts to drag his country into war, saying that Washington is not concerned about the security of Ukraine. Vladimir Putin made the remark during a joint press conference with the Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban. The Russian leader said it's wrong to allow one country to increase its security at the expense of another. Putin also accused the U.S. and its allies of ignoring proposals Moscow delivered to Washington for security guarantees over NATO's eastward expansion. Meanwhile, the Russian foreign minister said that his country will continue insisting on its security demands. Tensions escalated recently amid Western accusations that Russia is planning to invade Ukraine. Moscow has repeatedly rejected that accusation. Now, the conclusion of a much-anticipated inquiry into allegations of parties held at the UK Prime Minister's office during lockdowns last year is finally out. Although published in its redacted form, the report has fueled anger among the public, political opposition, and members of Boris Johnson's own Conservative Party. Say Puriza has more.
At 11:30 a.m. Monday, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson received an important email. In the attachment, a damning report into alleged parties under his roof last year. Among other things, a 13-page report by senior civil servant Sue Gray looked at 16 gatherings during the pandemic and found that the behavior was difficult to justify, with failures of leadership and judgment, and too little thought was given to what was happening across the country.
The complete version of the Sue Gray report is yet to be published, pending a police investigation. But the sheer scale of potential breaches meant that Boris Johnson had to face furious MPs in the building in penitent mode. Again.
I want to apologize. I know that millions of people across this country have made extraordinary sacrifices over the last 18 months.
To the opposition, sorry was not enough.
The British public aren't fools. They never believed a word of it. They think the Prime Minister should do the decent thing and resign. Of course he won't, because he is a man without shame.
He has been investigated by the police. He misled the House. He must now resign.
Members of the Prime Minister's own party didn't pull any punches either.
Either my right honourable friend had not read the rules, or didn't understand what they meant, and others around him, or they didn't think the rules applied to number 10. Which was it?
And while the Prime Minister and the people around him were allegedly having a good time away from prying eyes, the rest of the people adhered to the rules. Those who didn't were stopped unceremoniously.
What it would take for this Prime Minister to go, I don't know. If this doesn't get in his way, then God help us all, frankly, in terms of politics in this country.
People are sceptical, and I think a lot of people also kind of think with the police, you know, quite rightly, obviously, number 10, there's a police presence. So people in the police were aware that, or should have been aware that, you know, something was going on in the back garden.
While people were dying and while people were unable to attend funerals, for him to be holding parties and agreeing to parties to be held when he made the rules is fairly immoral.
The public mood here is one of outrage at the moment, but experts say what Boris Johnson desperately needs now is not public support, but the backing of his own party members to avoid a leadership challenge. Saeed Purizep, London.
Now, Iran is marking the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Event is marked every year with a 10-day celebration period known as a 10-day dawn. Our correspondent Yusuf Jalali has your story.
43 years ago, millions of Iranians flocked to Tehran's Mehrabad airport to welcome the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, back to the country after 14 years of exile. The historic day was a milestone that put an end to centuries of monarchy in Iran. Ever since, Iranians have celebrated the occasion every year for 10 days. The event starts on the anniversary of Imam Khomeini's homecoming and culminates on the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. This period is called Dehe Fajr, or the 10-day dawn. As with every year, the ceremonies began with a visit by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, to Imam Khomeini's mausoleum. The mausoleum also hosted state officials and people from all walks of life to mark the occasion.
Like every year, we gather today in this holy place to pay respect to Imam Khomeini, a man who changed the course of history in our country and established a political system that respects our beliefs as Muslims.
Today is an important day for us. We, the new generation, were not present those days, but we participate in this ceremony to learn about the personality of Imam Khomeini.
The Islamic Revolution was led by Imam Khomeini, who spent some 14 years in exile in Iraq, Turkey, and France, from where he led a swelling grassroots movement, which ultimately led to the toppling of former Iranian monarch Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. The revolution was driven by anti-imperialist sentiments, since Mohammad Reza Pahlavi was believed to be heavily dependent on Western powers, especially the U.S.
During the Shah period, other countries like the U.S. made decisions for us. Iran was a U.S. colony. They were in our country to plunder our oil and other resources.
We lost many of our beloved ones for the sake of the Islamic Republic. By celebrating the event, we seek to say no to foreign interference in our country. We still stick to those ideals no matter how much pressure and sanctions the U.S. imposes on our nation.
Less than 2 months after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iranians took part in a referendum where more than 98% of eligible voters voted yes to the Islamic Republic as a new political system.
To Iranians, the 10-day dawn is reminiscent of their struggle for independence, a legacy that they're not willing to give up on, even if it means they have to endure U.S. sanctions. Now, one of the major goals of holding such massive celebrations is to pass on these messages to new generations. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has called on Australia to act responsibly to counter active members of terrorist groups in the country. Amir Abdollahian made the request in a phone conversation with his Australian counterpart, Marisa Payne. The Iranian minister highlighted his country's leading role in the fight against terrorism, that is in efforts made by late Iranian commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, to promote regional peace and security. Elsewhere in his remarks, Amir Abdollahian said the two countries have the potential to boost ties in various fields, including trade, investment, and science. The Australian foreign minister, for her part, said that her country welcomes the expansion of relations with Iran in various fields. Now, the Iranian president has expressed hope for the expansion of ties between his country and China in light of the political trust between Tehran and Beijing. Ebrahim Raisi made the call in a message to President Xi Jinping on the occasion of the Chinese New Year. Raisi congratulated the government and people of China on the beginning of the Lunar New Year. The Iranian president hailed deep diplomatic relations between the two nations. He also touched on a landmark 25-year comprehensive cooperation plan between Tehran and Beijing. He also expressed confidence that the world will witness the successful holding of the Beijing Winter Olympics under Xi's wise leadership. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
in the limelight.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump's promise to pardon supporters who attacked the U.S. Capitol on 6th of January 2021 was the stuff of dictators, Richard Nixon's White House counsel has warned. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled, Trump Pardon Promise for Capitol Rioters, Stuff of Dictators, Nixon Aid. Former U.S. President Donald Trump's promise to pardon supporters who attacked the U.S. Capitol on 6th of January 2021 was the stuff of dictators, Richard Nixon's White House counsel has warned. Donald Trump made the promise at a rally in Conroe, Texas, on Saturday, 29th of January. If I run and if I win, he said, referring to the 2024 presidential election, we will treat those people from 6th of January fairly. We will treat them fairly, and if it requires pardons, we will give them pardons because they're being treated so unfairly. More than 700 people have been charged in connection with the Capitol attack, around which 7 people died, as Donald Trump's supporters tried to stop the certification of his election defeat in service of his lie that it was caused by electoral fraud. More than 100 police officers were hurt on that day. 11 members of the far-right Oath Keepers militia have been charged with seditious conspiracy. Donald Trump himself was impeached for inciting the riot. 10 House Republicans voted to impeach, but Trump was acquitted when only 7 Republican senators found him guilty. That left him free to run for office again. John Dean, 83, was White House counsel in the Nixon administration from 1970 to 1973, before being disbarred and detained as a result of the Watergate scandal, which led to Richard Nixon's resignation in 1974. John Dean responded to Donald Trump on Twitter, "This is beyond being a demagogue. To the stuff of dictators," he wrote. He is defying the rule of law. Failure to confront a tyrant only encourages bad behavior. If thinking Americans don't understand what Donald Trump is doing and what the criminal justice system must do, we're all in big trouble. Trump was generous with pardons in office. Recipients included Steve Bannon and Michael Flynn, both now targets of the House committee investigating the 6th of January riot and with Trump in its sights. On Sunday morning, the New Hampshire governor, Chris Sununu, widely seen as a relative moderate in Trump's Republican Party, was asked if pardons should be offered to Capitol rioters. "Of course not," he told CNN's State of the Union program. "Oh my goodness, no." Even Lindsey Graham, the South Carolina senator and dogged Trump ally, said the former president was wrong. "I don't want to send any signals that it was okay to defile the Capitol," he told CBS's Face the Nation. "I want to deter what people did on 6th of January and those who did it. I hope they go to jail and get the book thrown at them, because they deserve it." But a moderate Republican, Susan Collins of Maine, indicated the hold that Donald Trump has on the Republican Party. Appearing on ABC's This Week program, Senator Susan Collins said, "Donald Trump should not have made that pledge to do pardons. We should let the judicial process proceed." But Susan Collins, who voted to convict Trump over the Capitol attack, would not say that she would not support him if he ran for president again. Well, certainly, it's not likely given the many other qualified candidates that we have that have expressed interest in running, she said. So it's very unlikely. Donald Trump dominates polling concerning potential Republican nominees for the 2024 presidential race. Others deplored Trump's words in Texas. Richard Painter, a White House ethics counsel under George W. Bush, said the promise of pardons should, constitutionally speaking, stop Trump running again. This alone is giving aid or comfort to an insurrection within the meaning of the 14th Amendment, Section 3, Richard Painter wrote. Donald Trump is disqualified from public office, he wrote. Donald Trump also complained about investigations of his business and political affairs which have landed him in legal jeopardy. On Sunday, Lindsey Graham, whose actions in support of Donald Trump are being investigated in Georgia, said he would cooperate if asked. "Yeah," he said, "give me a call." But he also complained about a supposed effort here to use the law, I think, inappropriately. "So I don't know what they're going to do in Fulton County, Georgia. I don't know what the 6th of January committee is going to do. I expect those who defiled the Capitol to be prosecuted. But there is a political movement using the law to try to knock Trump out of running. And I particularly don't like it or accept it." In Texas, Donald Trump urged his supporters to protest. "If these radical, vicious, racist prosecutors do anything wrong or illegal," he said, "I hope we're going to have in this country the biggest protest we have ever had in Washington, D.C., in New York, in Atlanta, and elsewhere, because our country and our elections are corrupt." "Prosecutors," he said, "were trying to put me in jail. These prosecutors are vicious, horrible people. They're racist and they're very sick. They're mentally sick. They're going after me without any protection of my rights by the Supreme Court or most other courts." Glenn Kirshner, a former federal prosecutor and now a legal analyst for NBC, said, "Donald Trump is not only encouraging his supporters to violence if he's arrested, he's also signaling that he'll pardon them, just as he'll pardon the 6th of January insurrectionists. Will this finally move prosecutors to hold him accountable for his crimes?"
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum, and welcome to yet another edition from series of Q&A in Islamic beliefs from IRIB English Radio. Those who have been listening to this series of shows, they are quite familiar with the current that we have in this series of shows. We are trying to answer doubts and misconceptions that we receive from different questioners from around the world. And for that, we invite Islamic researchers, scholars from Qom Seminary Schools to help us with the answers. As usual, we have invited Sheikh Murtada Karimi, Islamic researcher and scholar from Qom Seminary Schools, to help us in this show. He is the guest of us in this studio. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for accepting the invitation. The question of the day is concerning the iddah, or a time period that ladies need to keep after the divorce or the demise of their husbands. The question exactly is that due to the advancement of science and technology and the different tools and instruments that help us to diagnose the pregnancy and DNA test, so why should the ladies and women keep this period of iddah after the divorce or the demise of the husbands? This is the question that we need Sheikh Murtada Karimi to shed some light on and explain about that. And before diving into the answer itself, I'd like Sheikh to briefly define the idea itself for those who have not been familiar with this term, for even those who are listening to us and they have no familiarity with Islamic beliefs. Sheikhna, thank you very much.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Let me share one verse in this regard and then I'll explain about the term, because this verse helps us understand the term too.
Yeah.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said in chapter At-Talaq, verse 1, A'udhu billahi minash shaitan ar-Rajim, Ya ayyuhan nabi, O the Prophet, إِذَا طَلَّقْتُمُ النِّسَاءَ, when you divorce women, فَطَلِّقُوهُنَّ لِعِدَّتِهِمْ, divorce them at the conclusion of their term, وَأَحْصُ الْعِدَّةَ, and calculate the term, and then be wary of Allah your Lord. So of course this verse is referring only to divorce, but we have the same regarding the demise of the husbands as well. So عِدَّةَ is referring to that period, to that term after the demise of the husband or after divorce. And this period has a couple of rulings, I mean based on Islamic jurisprudence. One of the most important ones is that those women are not permitted to get married to another husband except after passing this period.
True.
And we have different, we have many details in this regard, because as I mentioned, the term for demise is different from that of divorce. For the first, it is 4 months and 10 days. For divorce, in many cases, is three periods of menstruation, about 3 months. But for the details, our dear listeners need to refer to the religious authorities that they follow. Again, for the temporary marriage and for the permanent marriages, there are, different verdicts, so we are not going to talk about jurisprudence. So the point is that after divorce or after demise of the husband, women for something between 3 to 4 months and 10 days, they need to wait, then they are able to get married. Now many people think that the reason and the only reason for this period is that Islam says that woman might be pregnant, with the ex-husband who has passed away or who has divorced her. So that is why they need to be patient, so the matter would be clear whether they are pregnant or not. And then they claim that, okay, in our time, with the technology that we have, it could be, tested through technologies, and, the day after divorce or demise, scientists can tell you whether that lady is pregnant or not. So with these technologies, why people still should keep iddah? There are a couple of points that we need to take into consideration. First of all, when it comes to the philosophy of Islamic laws, I think I have mentioned this point in many sessions that for sure, all the Islamic laws, they have wisdom and they have philosophy, but it doesn't mean that we are able to know all the philosophies for all the details of the Islamic laws. With the help of the narrations and with rational arguments, we may find some of these philosophies for the Islamic laws, but there might be others which we are unaware of, and maybe in future we may come to know more. So we shouldn't expect to know about all the philosophies of all the Islamic laws. This is a very important point. But then
so it's not necessary to know that the lady is pregnant or not.
My point is that maybe it's not the only reason. Mm-hmm. Maybe there are some reasons that we are unaware of, and there are a couple of points that which confirm this point. Now, This is true that according to some narrations, one of the reasons for keeping Idda is to clarify whether that woman is pregnant or not. But we see that in some cases, although that woman cannot be pregnant at all, but Islam says that still those women should keep that period of Idda too. For example, we may think of a lady who is barren. I mean, she cannot give birth to a child. She's barren. But still, Islam says that you need to keep Idda. Or for example, imagine that a man and a couple, they live separately for a couple of years and then they get divorced. Still, Islam says that lady needs to keep Idda. This is referring to the fact that at least pregnancy is not the only reason, it's not the only philosophy. If it was the only philosophy, then in these cases Islam should have said that there is no need for keeping Idda.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Insha'Allah, you'll find your way. Now, the second point is that,
can it be said that Islam at that time had due to the lack of the, let's say, advanced instruments, actually verdict such a thing, and now today we are reaching to this conclusion, know that we have this, let's say, instrument and we are in a state to judge it better in no time?
As I mentioned, this is not the only philosophy, because at that time, if pregnancy was the only reason, why Islam says that even for barren women or for those wife and husband who live separately for a couple of years, still they need to keep Idda. This
Very
means
true.
That the issue of pregnancy is not the only philosophy.
So there are some other reasons behind that.
There might
Very
be
true.
One of the philosophies, but it's not the only philosophy. Second of all, when it comes to today's technology, I think even all the dear listeners can agree that at the end of the day, in all the cases, there is a chance of mistake, and we cannot ignore that. At least in our time, when it comes to deciding about a woman's pregnancy, in some cases, although they have gone for many tests, the result has been wrong, and later it is clarified. But let's go to other philosophies which still apply today, and that is why we believe that pregnancy is not the only philosophy for keeping Idda. Maybe the most important philosophy for Idda is that we know that in the religion of Islam, in most of the cases, that divorce is called Rajai, meaning that during that period, the man can return and they can renew the life again with the return of the man, of the husband, as if no divorce has happened at all. They do not need to recite those formula for marriage again. Mm-hmm. As soon as the man returns and he expresses that he regrets, then they can renew the life again. So it seems that this period of Idda is a period of rethinking about the situation, about the conditions, because sometimes both man and wife, they decide to separate and to do divorce because of some trivial and minor issues. But then Islam says that okay, for that lady, Islam says that wait for 3 months or for 4 months, and during that month, and it has happened a lot, those ladies who now are in new situation, without any husband, without any relation, they come to this understanding that it would be much better for them not to get divorced. So the period of Iddah is a very good solution from an Islamic perspective for a kind of peace and reconciliation and return of that man toward the woman as well.
True.
As I mentioned, in many cases for various reasons, we see that both man and woman rush toward divorce. Divorce happens, but Islam says that, okay, I mean, this is your right.
Mm-hmm.
But then Islam says to that woman that wait for 3 months or for 4 months.
And there is also a possibility of them regret for what they did and the decision
exactly.
that they made.
Yeah, exactly.
True.
So I believe that because of the fact that the institution of family is very respected in the religion of Islam.
And the hatred of divorce as well.
Exactly. It's highly discouraged. This period of Iddah is a chance for both man and woman to think to, I mean, let me refer to another point that according to the religion of Islam, during this time, the man is still should take care of the wife and continue to give her the sustenance.
Mm-hmm.
Even according to many scholars, she needs to stay in the house of that man. This is very interesting.
Yeah.
And which means that Islam does not want this institution to be demolished altogether. No. Islam says that woman that you have all the right to continue to even live in the house of that man, although you are not mahram to each other. You cannot have any intimate relationship.
Mm-hmm.
But, and at the same time, you cannot get married to another husband, to another man. Which means that for at least 3 months, you have the chance to, I mean, you are provided that by that man, but you have no relationship with him. So it's a good opportunity for both of them to think more. I mean, when you are alone, when you do not have that relation anymore, so at least if there is a possibility for them to regret and to come back to life. And some people, they because they rush toward divorce, they do not think about the conditions and what will happen to the children.
Mm-hmm.
This time is a good time to think about that aspect of life too.
Can I ask a question here?
Sure, please.
There are some ways that some people suggest some ways to shorten this period. I mean, is it possible to shorten this period due to some, let's say they use different pills and to shorten this period? Is it allowed in Islam or not?
No, it's not allowed because, as I mentioned, we are not talking about pregnancy as the the only philosophy. You are talking about, I mean, divorce and not demise. Because
yes.
For demise, the iddah is 4 months and 10 days.
So there are different terms of iddah, yes.
But when it comes to divorce, it's been mentioned that it's 3 periods of menstruation and being clean from that. Then, according to some scholars, it might be shortened through some pills, but there might be a difference of ideas. For that, people need to refer to the scholars that they follow.
Religious authority that they are following.
Yeah, related to that, a specific iddah, which is related to divorce.
But as
at
for
the day,
demise and passing away of the husband,
no,
it needs to...
4 months and 10 days. Yeah.
Very true. So it cannot be shortened anyway.
Still, people can refer to the religious authorities, but as far as I know from Islamic jurisprudence, it is mentioned to be 4 months and 10 days, and it cannot be reduced. So the main point that I'd like to share is the fact that especially the women after divorce, they suffer more than men because, mentally speaking and psychologically speaking, women are symbols of feelings, and after divorce, they may suffer more than men. So keeping iddah, Islam does not want women just to go to think about another marriage and getting married to another man. So the period and the term of iddah is a good opportunity not only for women but also for men to reconsider their decision, and maybe they will return to the life and continue living together, inshallah.
Thank you very much, dear Sheikh, for your beautiful explanations, and your respected listeners for staying tuned and listening to IRB English Radio with the series of Q&A and Islamic Beliefs from IRB English Radio. I hope you enjoyed it, and he will join us again in our upcoming session.
إن في الجنة نهرا لبن علي وحسين وحسن.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A study finds that average Briton produces more carbon in 2 days than a Congolese person does in an entire year. We now present you an article written by Karen McVeigh. The piece is titled, West Accused of Climate Hypocrisy as Emissions Dwarf Those of Poor Countries. According to an analysis by the Center for Global Development, in the first 2 days of January, the average Briton was already responsible for more carbon dioxide emissions than someone from the Democratic Republic of Congo would produce in an entire year. The study, which highlights the vast energy inequality between rich and poor countries, found that each Briton produces 200 times the climate emissions of the average Congolese person, with people in the United States producing 585 times as much. It found by the end of January, the carbon emitted by someone living in the United Kingdom will surpass the annual emissions of citizens of 30 low and middle income countries. Ewan Ritchie, a policy analyst at the Center for Global Development Europe, said his work was prompted by the climate hypocrisy of Western countries, including the United Kingdom and the United States, that have pledged to stop aid funding to fossil fuel projects in developing states. Ewan Ritchie said, at COP26, there was lots of hand-wringing by rich countries about the extent to which aid and other development finance should finance fossil fuels in poorer countries. The hypocrisy of this caught my attention. Ewan Ritchie noted, our analysis shows that In just a few days, the average person in the United Kingdom produces more climate emissions than people in many low-income countries do in an entire year. It would be a cruel irony if the countries that have least contributed to this problem won't be able to have access to energy infrastructure. Several countries, including some developing countries and finance institutions, have signed up to a pledge to end public support for international fossil fuel projects. The same countries will be able to continue to develop fossil fuels at home. The United States has at least 24 pending fossil fuel projects, representing more than 1.6 gigatons of potential greenhouse gas emissions, while the United Kingdom is licensing new oil and gas fields in the North Sea. The Center for Global Development research used World Bank data of per capita carbon emissions for each country spread out over a year to calculate the point at which a British or an American citizen's energy use surpassed that of someone living in low or middle income country. About 940 million people, mainly in sub-Saharan Africa, do not have access to electricity. African leaders, including President Muhammadu Buhari of Nigeria, who has committed Nigeria to net zero emissions by 2060, and Lazarus Chakwera, the President of Malawi, have spoken out about their country's need to transition to net zero emissions via natural gas. The Energy for Growth Hub, an international research network, estimates that if 48 countries in Africa, excluding South Africa and several North African nations, tripled their electricity consumption through use of natural gas, the resulting carbon emissions would be less than 1% of the global total. Vijaya Ramachandran, the Director of Energy and Development at the Breakthrough Institute in Berkeley, California, argues that blanket bans on fossil fuel projects in poor countries are colonial and will entrench poverty while doing little to reduce the world's carbon dioxide emissions. She said, "It's very easy for rich countries to impose fossil fuel financing bans on poor countries while at the same time increasing their own consumption of fossil fuels." She added, "It's rank hypocrisy and it's devastating for poor countries as they need a wide range of energy to fuel development." She noted, "It's well known renewable energy is intermittent and needs to be backed up by other sources of energy. Telling African countries they just need solar power is completely hypocritical and colonial." Rose Mutiso, the Research Director of Energy for Growth Hub, said the Center for Global Development Research should be used to inform the debate over responsibility for the climate crisis. Rose Mutiso, who is a Kenyan, said, "Solving the climate crisis in the medium term is the responsibility of high-emitting countries, not only because they caused the problem in the first place, but logically, it's where high emissions are concentrated." She said, "The video gaming industry in California is using more energy than entire African countries. There's this idea that in California we can't live without video games or air conditioning, but we are worried about Africans moving up and consuming. It's really important for us as Africans to establish that our development is non-negotiable. All of those decades of exploitation and being left behind that is owed to us." Rose Mutiso cited a 2019 study that estimated electricity demand from the gaming industry in California alone would grow from 5 terawatt hours in 2011 to as much as 11 terawatt hours by 2021, the same as Sri Lanka's entire electricity consumption. Meanwhile, electricity could be delivered to more than a billion people currently living without it within a decade by linking up small-scale projects into a giant environmentally friendly network. According to a new global commission, advances in micro-energy grids and renewable energy technologies could dramatically accelerate change and transform lives in rural areas of sub-Saharan Africa and also in South Asia. The Global Commission to End Energy Poverty met for the first time recently to set out plans to accelerate the United Nations Sustainable Development Goal to ensure access to affordable, reliable, and sustainable energy for all the peoples of the world by 2030. The Commission, established by the Massachusetts Institute of Technology Energy Initiative and the Rockefeller Foundation, plans to bring together leading investors, utilities, and policymakers to tackle energy poverty. Under the initiative, the distributed networks would help connect homes, businesses, and schools to small-scale solar power projects to deliver cheap, sustainable electricity that can help power local economic growth. The Commission includes government leaders, energy industry chief executives, and representatives from major development organizations. Dr. Rajiv Shah, president of the Rockefeller Foundation and formerly of the U.S. Agency for International Development, said, "A whole new way of thinking about energy distribution was required." Dr. Rajiv Shah said, "We cannot end poverty without successfully ending energy poverty. For 140 years, we've had this mindset that energy access means building big power plants and connecting them to national grids, and that's how you provide electricity." Dr. Rajiv Shah noted, "Today, new technology frontiers, business models, and our knowledge of alternatives is so strong that this commission will be able to set out a new roadmap to end the energy access problem for 1 billion people across the globe." The Commission also plans to help set up new regulation in developing countries to accelerate the rollout of new energy systems and make the projects more attractive to international investors. Dr. Rajiv Shah explained, "If I want to start a small solar-powered mini-grid program in a rural part of an underserved country, I could be prevented from actually providing power without permission from the state-owned utility, which might own that business opportunity. That's one of the many policy roadblocks that is preventing distributed solutions from really being easy to invest in." Dr. Rajiv Shah will co-chair the commission alongside Dr. Ernest Moniz, a former U.S. Energy Secretary, and Dr. Akinwumi Adesina, the president of the African Development Bank. Dr. Ernest Moniz warned that existing plans to end global energy poverty by 2030 are not fast enough and should be more ambitious. He said, "20 years ago, energy access might have been defined by having a 20-watt light bulb. One doesn't want to denigrate that. The shift from having no light to some light is major, but our ambition is more than that. We want energy access that allows for credible family, community, and regional economic development. Frankly, we'd like it to allow for entrepreneurial activity as well." Dr. Moniz said that by relying on renewable energy, particularly solar power, alongside batteries, developing nations should be able to attract investment in clean energy and rule out the need for future investments in coal-fired power plants. He said adapting such methods could also halt the wood burning that has led to mass deforestation in some countries.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com.